Okay, could you push the left-hand one? Let's see if it does the right thing. Okay, so just for a moment of projection, this is, for those who care, this is Herbert S. Jennings, who was the first one in 1916, I think, or 17, to publish a paper showing the change of frequencies at two loci, two linked loci, as a function of how linked they were. And initiate the whole area that comes under the heading of linkage disequilibrium measures of association between different loci. And as I mentioned last time, he then subsequently abandoned population genetics and went to become the founder of work in protozoan genetics. Having done my projection, I'm then going to turn it off, and we shall see. If the system, I guess if you push the button again, is that an off button? Anything you can do, good. And then it will, it hopefully will not start projecting again. Okay. So where we were was starting in on that, and we got to the first equation. Basically, you imagine a population. It follows all the rules of Hardy-Weinberg. That is, it's infinitely large population, no selection, no migration, no mutation. Get genotype frequencies. We're back at an autosomal locus. Genotype frequencies the same in both sexes. But we have two loci, and there are two alleles at each of the two loci. So there are different possible gametes you could have. You could sort of think of these as chromosomes, but actually we could be talking about loci on different chromosomes too. Just thinking in terms of haploid genomes in gametes. We also are going to be following the frequency of one type here, big A, big B. And that means actually, even if there were like six alleles at the A locus and four alleles at the B locus, it would still be okay. We can follow that one type. So although I said there were two alleles at each locus, that isn't strictly speaking necessary. And we're following the frequency among gametes, or haploid genotypes, of that type. And we're going to be relying on random mating and on the principle that random mating is equivalent to random combinations of gametes. So these are really just talking about the gamete frequencies, which are kind of like gene frequencies, but there also are gene frequencies, because you can imagine that whatever the frequencies of all of these four are, you can go out into that population of gametes and take a survey and say, what fraction of them have big A? So there's also a frequency little p sub big A, and another one little p sub big B. That is, there are gene frequencies, and we're just going to use subscripts to indicate which locus and which allele we're talking about. Now, if we go on to the next generation, the first thing I want you to consider and answer for me is, what is the gene frequency of big A in the next generation? We're not talking about the gamete, big A, big B, but we're talking about at the single locus, the A locus, what's the frequency of big A in the next generation? I know this is so obvious, but somebody's got to answer it.
Is it 1/2?
No. Not necessarily, could be. Sorry? So the next generation, the gene frequency is going to be the same as it was in this generation, because after all, that's what we got when we looked at a single locus. And when we look at a single locus, yeah, there's lots of other loci around it, but we're just not paying attention to them. And so whatever the gene frequency was, like 0.06, in this generation, it'll be 0.06 in the next generation. So for the gene frequencies at the individual loci of the alleles, they just go on under Hardy-Weinberg and stay the same from generation to generation. But this thing, P big A big B, does not, because of recombination having an effect on it. And to remind you, there were two situations. These two loci are separated by an amount of genotype that leads to them having a recombination fraction of some sort. Let's call it little r. They could be on different chromosomes, in which case r is 1/2. And so there are two situations. One is no recombination between the A locus and the B locus in the segregation that gives rise to a gamete. So we're going to consider a random gamete from the next generation. We've taken these gametes, we made parent, we made diploid genotypes, and then they're going to give rise to gametes. So we're in that. We're now computing those gamete frequencies in the next generation, which we'll use a prime for. And there are going to be two cases, one of which there's no recombination and one of which there is a recombination. And as I indicated, that's not the same as saying a crossover, because if there's an odd number of crossovers, that's one recombination. So 1 minus r of the time, this happens 1 minus r of the time, that happens r of the time, you will get a gamete which is one of the two that was in that parent. And being one of the two, it is a random gamete from the previous set of gametes. And the frequency, the probability that it's a big A, big B is just that piece of big A, big B in our starting pool of gametes in our previous generation. R of the time, there will be a crossover, so that, or a recombination, an odd number of crossovers, so that when we look at these two spots in the genome and we say, well, what we have to put here is the probability that this is a big A and this here is a big B, both at the same time. Now, those are two different gametes that came together to form that diploid individual. And if we ask ourselves, what if I pick a gamete at random from the gametes that form this individual, what's the probability that it has a big A? I think you answered this last time, but
the same.
It is
the same as what? The previous generation.
Which of these quantities?
Yeah.
A little piece of big
P big A, yeah. So the probability that this is a big A is piece of big A. The probability that that is a big B is piece of big B. What's the probability that one is a big A and the other is a big B?
Piece of A times piece of B.
It's a product. Why?
Because each of them are independent events that need to happen.
Yeah, each of them is a randomly sampled gamete. And what you got on the first one has no effect on what you get in the second one because of random mating. So given that this formed by random mating, the term you want here is simply the product of the gene frequency, so P big A, little p big A, little p big B. Okay, that's the equation we got two last time at the end. And now what we have to say is, well, what's going to happen if we go forward another generation? And the answer is we can simply take this number, put it in here. The gene frequencies haven't changed. And we can keep going. So if you crank that formula, what happens to it? Well, in the limit with R, any R but zero, in the limit, it's going to go to the product of the two gene frequencies. And the one way to show that is to say, let's make a number which is a difference between P big A big B and that product. So ask, how far is it from that product? Well, that you can get just by subtracting P big A big B from this equation. So it's this minus P little p big A little p big B.
So does that mean a linear difference equation is actually related to the difference quotient in taking limits?
The difference quotient.
Like when you take the limits and you...
Well, here, where things are so simple that we don't kind of use that machinery, because that's for multiple variables generally. This is too pathetically simple to use real mathematics on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm a little confused. What are you doing here?
What I'm doing is saying, okay, I want to know where this guy, thank you all for continuing to bother me with questions, because that's important. This thing I claimed was going to that product, P big A, P big, but why should you believe me? Well, what I'm going to do is derive the difference of it from that product and ask if that goes to zero.
Okay.
And I do it by just taking that first equation and I just subtract the product from both sides. And then we find that, well, let's write it in here just so your eye more easily sees it. And what you can do is say, well, there's a 1 minus r here, and if you look closely, these things are the same, but there's an arm and a minus 1. So you can pull a 1 minus r out front and get P big A big B minus the product. So high school algebra, or second, or possibly middle school algebra. So what we've got is that the departure of big A, of this fraction of big A big B, this haplotype frequency from this product of gene frequencies gets multiplied, whatever it was in the previous generation, gets multiplied by 1 minus r. And now r is a recombination fraction. It's somewhere between 0 and a half, actually. They don't get up as high as 1. And that means it's a number less than 1. So the departure will be in the same direction in the next generation, but smaller, because it's been multiplied by a fraction. And so one thing I want to do is also give a name to this. This is a measure called D, and D prime is 1 minus R times D, and D is the thing that is the linkage. It's a measure of linkage disequilibrium. The D was discovered. It was called delta then. And by R. B. Robbins, the year after Jennings published his paper, he published a paper saying, "Hey, if you take this thing, you call it, give it a name, and it's going down." The name linkage disequilibrium was provided not till much later, 1960. Paper by Lewontin and Kojima. It is widely regarded as a not terribly great name. It's hard to remember. The name implies that, oh, it's something to do with linkage, and if you didn't have any linkage, surely this is zero, and that's not true. So it's a kind of bad name. Plus, what does disequilibrium mean? So it's come to be called, in people working in genomics, LD. And I think they've now forgotten what LD stands for. And it's just this magic stuff called LD. So it's just a measure of how far away you are in your particular frequency of this particular haplotype from what you would get if you just threw genes in at random. If you said, oh, we'll grab a random big A and stick it into this haplotype, and a random B allele and stick it in, then we would get these product frequencies. And you can see that what's going to happen is after t generations, you keep multiplying by 1 minus r each generation. So you'll get 1 minus r t times t times whatever the initial d was. The initial d, by the way, could be either positive or negative. Positive at big A, big B is more frequent than expected on the random from random association. Another good word to use for this is that the topic we're looking at is association of alleles at one locus with another. Or it could be negative, meaning it's less frequent than the product. Both are possible. But whatever it is, it's getting multiplied again and again by 1 minus r, which is a number less than 1, and it's headed for 0. And then you have to say, well, how quickly? And that there, it's very easy. You have to say, well, how long before it gets halfway there? That'll be when this thing is 1 half. So when we say 1 minus r to the t is 0.5, when is that? Well, to find out that, you take logarithms of both sides, t times the log of 1 minus r, and this is the log of 0.5. And then you solve. Log of 0.5, as you all know, is 0.693147. Okay. Well, maybe you don't know it, but I used to do, when I was young, I used to amaze people by my mental computations, which I did by the simple expedient of memorizing the answer. And then you dole it out one digit at a time, but taking with greater and greater time between the digits, because it's obvious you're doing lots of stuff in your head. I'd say 693, 1, 4, you know, and you'd say, wow, he's calculating this number. I never calculated any of them. This here is log of 1 minus r, and you might say, well, what's that going to be? For r small, the log of 1 plus anything or 1 minus anything is approximately that thing. So the log of 1 minus r would be approximately minus r. And I made a mistake here and nobody caught me. The log of 0.5 is minus 0.693147. So this will be approximately minus this thing, which is about 0.7, really, over minus r. So by taking a few numbers, you can get a feel for it. Suppose r is 1%. So you have things far enough apart in the genome that they have 1% recombination. That's in the vicinity of, let me see, that would be in the vicinity of 10, I believe 10, it's not as small as 10 kilobases, wait. Recombination fraction is 1 every 10 to the 8th, roughly, in the human genome. So 1% of that would be 1 million bases. So you're about a million bases down the genome is 1% recombination. The catch is, of course, in the actual human genome, there are hot and cold regions for recombination. So it isn't quite that simple. So then, that would be minus 0.693147 over minus 0.01, and that will be, I think you can see, 69.3147, about 70 generations to get halfway to random combination proportions. If you're closer, say 0.001, then it's going to be 693 generations. So it's going to take not quite 1,000 generations to get partway there. 1,000 generations in humans is, of course, about 25,000 years. So that would carry you, if you go back 25,000 years, you're way before agriculture. So it's a considerable time. And 0.1% is about 100 kilobases in the genome. When you get to smaller regions, like when you start looking at the things in a single locus, you can see that to get them into random combination proportions by having the right amount of recombination will take you longer, and it's going to take thousands and thousands of generations. So anything that moves a population out of random combination proportions gradually that decays and gets back to them, but it can take a long time if those are nearby sites. On the other hand, if they're, what if they're, this is a silly question, what if they're far enough apart for a recombination fraction of about a half? That will occur basically at the other end of a big chromosome, or if you're on a different chromosome. How long will it take for this number to fall by half? Trick question. One exact, yeah, no more 0.693s, one generation. Because it gets multiplied by half each generation. So but the other thing to say is, if you're out of linkage equilibrium is when D equals zero. So, and the fact that it says equilibrium does not imply that there's any force pushing the gene frequencies anywhere. So again, a sort of bad a bad terminology, but we're stuck with it. When you're out of linkage equilibrium and you're on a different chromosome, so there's R equal 1/2, you don't immediately, in spite of having independent segregation a la Gregor Mendel, you don't go all the way to linkage equilibrium in one generation. You only go halfway there. So, okay. So now this is what happens to the haplotype frequencies. Now what I want to do is reconsider it and go back through looking at the diploid genotypes and give you some feel for what's happening with the diploid genotypes. I also should give you some orientation as to how this fits into the course. Let me do that first. We're having this lecture on it, and that's it. For the rest of the course, we mostly won't talk about this, even though, from a genomic point of view, it's terribly important. This is not, I mean, when I talked about sex linkage and what that does, the bizarre oscillations and so forth, that's more or less mathematical playing around. It isn't all that important. But this is important because it deals with how departures from random combination, what happens to them in populations. In the rest of the course, we'll mostly be working one locus at a time. In the textbook, in the book, chapter 9, I believe, is, no, chapter 8. Double check. Look at this one. I want to make sure I get the name right. I believe it's chapter 8. Just to be sure. Chapter 8 in the textbook is all about natural selection on multiple loci when you have epistasis, that is, interaction of fitnesses. That can create linkage disequilibrium. Recombination breaks it down. You have a struggle between the two. You also have linkage disequilibrium can be created a couple of other ways. One important way is by admixture. So if you say, if we look in the population at, let's say, a locus that has to do with eye color, and some people may have blue eyes, and a locus that has to do with hair color, some people may have blonde hair, I mean naturally blonde hair. Well, we know that there are populations in which you have a lot of blue eyes and blonde hair, and there are others in which you don't have many. The distribution worldwide of eye color and hair color is not independent. That means if I take a population and I bring people from different parts of the world, you'll start out with those loci in linkage disequilibrium. Why? Because of admixture resulting from migration of different populations. So mixing different populations, putting them in the same place and then having them become a new population starts you in linkage disequilibrium without any natural selection having been involved. And it would then, to the extent that people random mated, it will gradually, that association would gradually disappear. So natural selection can create linkage disequilibrium, so can admixture. And so can genetic drift in a modest-sized population. We'll be talking a lot about genetic drift, one locus at a time. but it also can randomly create linkage disequilibrium just by random associations. And because of tight, if there's tight linkage, if R is small, those persist for a while. So all of those forces can create linkage disequilibrium. Chapter 8 is about that. But we won't have time to get to it. So if you want to know more about it, go read Chapter 8, basically. Okay, now let's look at multiple loci. And I'm now, I think I'll try to start over here. I'm having my usual bored real estate problem. Let's imagine two loci with two alleles. So we'll go back to the two allele case with two loci. We have, if we make up what is in fact a Punnett square, that is a diagram of all the gametes that can combine, we have the four possibilities from one parent, let's say from males, and from females we have the four possibilities. And there they are, and you can immediately see, okay, that gives us 16 cells here. And we have all the genotypes. So this genotype is big A, big B, over big A, big B, and so on. And I can draw them all in, and I'm not going to do that, but we'll start in on that. And you can imagine them all drawn in. Okay. Now you can say, well, let's suppose that we forget about this way of doing things, and we go instead for gamete frequencies. We say, we have four gametes, they have some frequencies in the population. They're the same, assumed the same in male and female. Let's just call them X1, X2, X3, and X4. I think in the notes, I want to be consistent, I think I may have subscripted them with the genotypes themselves. So let me just double check that to make sure. And yeah, I think what I was doing in the notes is using the capital P notation. Let me leave it with the X's here. It's not the same as the textbook then, but as long as you know. So X1, X2, X3, X4. And then we can say, well, with random mating, what will be the frequencies of each of these 16 cells? So then we say, well, it's just the probability that the gamete coming from the male has a particular particular haplotype, and the gamete coming from the female has a particular other haplotype. And they're random mating, so we just get to take products. So, I'll do it in red. Start putting some of those numbers in. This one is going to be X1 quantity squared. This one is going to be X1, X2. Let's try to get that better. This will be X1, X3, and this X1, X4. And then we go on down here, X2, X1, X2 squared, X2, X3, and X2, X4. And we'll write them all in. Almost there, X3 squared, X3, X4, X4, X3. And X4 squared, if anyone's listening to the audio recording later, you'll be confused because I was out of order in the table. Okay, so there are all of those. And now we just have to say, suppose I look at a gamete in the next generation, what's the probability that it's a big A, big B? So what we're doing is we're redoing this algebra, but now taking all the genotypes, the diplogenotypes, into account, because I want to show you some things about that. Well, which one of these genotypes can produce a big A, big B? So all the genotypes in the first row have a big A, big B in the bottom of the genotype. This will be little a, little b over big A, big B. everything in the first column has a big A, big B in the top, the way I'm drawing them here. And now I'm going to say, okay, are those the only genotypes that can produce a big A, big B gamete?
No.
Why not?
On one chromosome or two?
In a gamete, in a single haplotype coming out of that individual, it's producing gametes.
Just a gamete. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
No.
Somebody see something else. Okay, what is it? You nodded. So that nodding or scratching your ear are dangerous in this class. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
So a couple of those combinations can recombine.
Okay, which ones?
So the second row and third column.
Second row and which?
Third column.
So that gamete will be a big A, let's do this correctly, a little a big B over a big A little b. That can recombine. You're quite right. That can recombine and produce a big A big B. Anything else? That one is big A, little b, over little a, big b. Anybody else? Now, we're ruled out mutation. Of course, if there were mutation, then anybody could produce a big A, big b. So these are, in fact, the only gametes that can produce a big A, big b. So, what fraction of gametes coming from the first genotype up here will be big A, big B?
All
of them. Okay. So there are X1 squared, so the new value of X1, the frequency X1 in the next generation will be X1 squared. Everybody is, of course, contributing equally per individual to the gametes because of our assumptions. When they are big A, big B homozygote, all the gametes they produce will be of that sort. How about this one here in the second row, second column of the first row? What fraction of its gametes you are now? I was going to say Gregor Mendel, but recombination was not known until 1904, so you are a Bateson and Punnett in 1904. What fraction of these, of the gametes coming out of this, will be big A, big B?
A little even more than a half. One X, two, plus.
More than a half? Anyone disagree with that? I'm fishing for a disagreement.
Less than a half, because 7 out of 16, you should get it, like, at least. So for 6 of them, you're going to get it half the time. For 1 of them, you're going to get it all the time.
Wait, 6 of who?
6 of the potential combinations.
Well, I'm just asking about this one here.
Oh, okay.
This guy here. What fraction of the time does that one produce a big A, big B gamete? One way of looking at it is look at the V locus. What fraction of the time will you get a big B?
Always.
All the time. Okay. Now, what fraction of the time are you going to get a big A?
Half the time.
Half, because that locus is segregated. So for that, it's a half. So there'll be a half X1, X3. Now we'll go over to, sorry, for this one, it'll be half X1, X2. I happen to point to the third one. There's also a half X1, X3. So these two both produce halves because it's just one locus segregating. But what about this one? That's where it gets trickier. X1, the frequency of this genotype is X1, X4.
This one again?
Upper. Upper, right.
A quarter?
A quarter, say you. Well, if recombination fraction is very small, will that be true?
Then it would just be a half.
Then if it's zero, it would just be a half because there's two gametes to segregate. So it depends on the recombination fraction. If there's no recombination, what it is it? It's a half. Okay, so no recombination, that's going to occur 1 minus r of the time. It's 1 half, I'm sorry. And if there is recombination, what fraction of the time will you get a big A, big B? Sorry, somebody said that. If there is recombination, what's the probability of coming out with a big A, big B in that?
Zero.
Zero. Because you, if you have recombination, you just don't. Okay. So it's a half times 1 minus R. So this will be a half times 1 minus R times the frequency of that diploid genotype. Now there's the column. There's the first column as well. That gives you another half X2, X1, and a half X3, X1. And then you have this one down here, and it works out the same. It's a half times 1 minus R times X4, X1. Now there's still two of them that we haven't taken into account. Let's look at this X2, X3. X2, X3, but what do I put in front of it? What's the probability of a big A and a big B coming out of this gene?
Whatever R is?
Sorry, you said?
Depends on R, right?
Depends on R. If there is a recombination here, if there's no recombination there, what's the probability that will, that you'll get a big A, big B?
Zero.
And if there is a recombination, it's 1/2. Because there's two ways things can come out of a recombination, one of which is the one we're looking for. So we have a half R. And the same thing is true for X3, X2. Sorry, Okay, so there we are. It's kind of tedious. You, by the way, have similar expressions for the other three haplotypes, but I'm not going to write them out. And now, if we can look at some of these and say, well, look, X1, X2 is the same as X2, X1, we can add those up. If we start adding things up, I claim that what we're going to get, I'll write it back over on this side. The new gamete frequency is equal to X1 squared plus X1 X2 plus X1 X3 plus X1 X4. These are terms that don't have an R in them. And then there are the terms that have an R in them. R times minus X1, X4, plus X2, X3. What I've done is just combined together X1, X terms with the X2, X1 terms. That gets rid of the half. Done that for X1, X3. Done it for the leading term here with the X1, X4s, and so on. So all the halves have gone away. And now I look at it and I say, well, let's look at this. What is it? Oh, it looks terribly complicated, but not really. First of all, you use your sophisticated mathematical technique known as high school algebra, and you see that every term has an X1 in it, and your knee-jerk response should be to factor it out. And then you're left with X1 plus X2 plus X3 plus X4, which is the total frequency of everything. And I'll write the rest of the expression just in a convenient way, just there while I'm at it. Well, the sum of X1 plus X2 plus X3 plus X4 is what? Is it, for example, pi, or is it the logarithm of 73?
It's 1.
It's 1. It's 1 because those are the frequencies of everything, of all the time. We added up the frequencies of all the gametes, so they have to be 1. So that simply goes away. And then we get X1 minus this R times this thing. And you look at it and say, well, it's kind of interesting. It's symmetrical. It's the product of the two outermost gametes times minus the product of the innermost gametes. By the way, when we have big A and big B and we're kind of considering them to be corresponding to each other, we often will call those coupling and the others repulsion. It's antique terminology, but that the double heterozygotes here, these two are coupling double heterozygotes, and those are repulsion double heterozygotes. We look and say, okay, but now what relationship does that have to what we did before? What we did before was we had, you'll remember, we had the frequency of big A, big B in the next generation, and that's the same thing as X1 prime, was equal to P, that frequency times 1 minus R, plus R times the product of the gene frequencies. Now, this expression should be equal to that expression. They're the same thing, really. And what we're seeing here is that one can be rewritten as the frequency of big A, big B, minus the terms involving R, P, big A, big B, minus P, little a, little p, little a, little p, big B. Sorry, little p, big A, little p, big B. And now you look at them, and all they're kind of corresponding. The first term is the same. That's just what we were calling X1. Minus R times something, and there. And that was, of course, D, the difference between the frequency of the haplotype and its random, the random association expectation of it. Down here, it's this thing, x1, x4, minus x2, x3. So D is equal to this product of the outermost gametes minus the product of the innermost. It's D is equal to the difference between those as well. Same number. Now you might look at that and say, oh, okay, well, that's nice that it has this form, but so what? But another way of thinking is, look at the double heterozygotes in this table. In the double heterozygotes, we have these here. Those are double heterozygotes, and these and those. So with the counter diagonal of the table. And if you look at the frequencies here, this is X1, X4, and that is X2, X3. So suppose you're in linkage equilibrium, that is, you're in random association. So every gamete's frequency is just the product of the corresponding gene frequencies. Then the coupling double heterozygote frequency, X1, X4, should equal the repulsion double heterozygote frequency. In that case, not when you have linkage disequilibrium. There they are. If D is zero, if you've gotten to random combinations, those two are supposed to be equal to each other. So that's useful. And the other thing to say about all this, this is all with two loci. You can go to three and four loci. This was done by Hilde Geiringer in 1945. And she showed that with three and four loci, if you have some recombination, they go to random combination proportions, not only in pairwise, but in considered in threes and fours. The most general proof was given for using something called genetic algebras in 1962, by a Norwegian mathematician named Olav Ryerson. He proved for any number of loci, if you have recombination in every interval, you go to these random mating combinations. Norway is a small country. A friend of mine is Norwegian. I was talking to him one day, and I said, this was done by some strange Norwegian mathematician who were working on obscure things called Olav Ryerson. And he said, oh, Olav Ryerson, he married my cousin. Anyway, So you can't talk to anybody without them knowing somebody else. I think everyone in Norway knows everybody else, but that's not true. Maybe Iceland. Okay. But there's one more thing to say about all this, and that is what it does for you, what linkage equilibrium does for you if the population gets there. And this is a good thing to end on. If D is goes to zero between every pair of loci and every higher order combination as well, and there are higher order linkage, there are three locus linkage disequilibrium quantities that you can define, and those go to zero too. Once they all get there, you have a very interesting, very useful situation, because it turns out then that if you take a genotype like A1, A1, B3, B7, C4, C6, B2 squared, not squared, B2, B2, it's not squared, it's not an algebraic expression, it's a genotype, sorry. There's a genotype, what's its frequency? And you might think, oh, we're going to have to get haplotype frequencies and it's going to be a mess. And the answer is no, because if D has reached zero, so there is no association, then the genotypes that you have at each locus are independent of the genotypes at the next locus. And it will be true, the genotype of this will be its Hardy-Weinberg expectation, P sub 1 squared. Suppose I call the gene frequencies at the first locus P and the second locus Q, maybe I'll say P sub A1 squared. And the second locus, it'll be P sub B3, P sub B7 times 2, because there's two ways of getting that heterozygote, and so on. Twice P sub C4, P sub C6, and finally P sub D2 squared. So you can go along through the genome and just multiplying Hardy-Weinberg proportions, and you can get the frequency of every genotype. And that's tremendously useful. Let me just end on this. Because if you start thinking about how many genotypes there are, suppose we had 10 loci and we just have two alleles each. Okay. Well, for haplotypes, there are 2 to the 10 haplotypes. And how many genotypes are there? Well, there are 3 genotypes, not considering coupling or repulsion, but just considering the genotypes at the locus. There are 3 possible genotypes at each locus. So there are 3 to the 10, which I happen to know is 59,049 genotypes possible. And you might think that following these through a population under randomity, you would have to define 59,000 quantities and follow them. Or somebody might say, well, no, because of random mating, all you have to do is know the haplotype frequencies. Well, there's 1,024 of those. So you're still going to have 1,024 things to follow. But if you're in linkage equilibrium, no. All you have to know is the gene frequencies at each locus. There are 2 alleles at each locus, so there's really just 1 gene frequency. There are just 10 gene frequencies. So if you're in linkage equilibrium, the number of the dimensionality of the population is reduced greatly, and you can just think of the genotype, the haplotypes, as just random combinations of one allele at each locus. You can think of the genotypes as pairs of combinations, 2 at each locus. And the dimensionality that you have to think about boils back down to the gene frequencies at each locus. And that's why we talk about populations as gene pools. Yes, that's a good moment for a question, and I have run a little over on my apologies.
So how do you approach the problem of computing in a particular code if you have a large number of those times?
You worry. You pull out hair and you fret and you stay up late and you write programs that have 1,024 variables. And then you multiply them together and try to figure. You know, it's a mess.
So, are there models which kind of simplify the problem so it's computationally feasible if you had maybe 10 power to the 6 on microorganisms like that?
What sometimes happens is that the number of possible haplotypes is small, that they're so tightly associated that most possible haplotypes don't occur. Then you can just follow frequency of those until there's a recombination that creates a new haplotype. So, it's worrisome. What I will show you when we get, particularly if you go to chapter 8 and read it, you'll see that if fitnesses multiply across loci, which is a natural assumption if they don't interact, you can also show that if you get to linkage equilibrium, that sort of natural selection will not perturb you away from linkage equilibrium. Yeah, see, this is important stuff, and it will be covered in the second quarter of the course, which unfortunately doesn't exist. I better let you out of here. Held you over. I will be assigning another homework today. I want to get the homeworks back into Wednesday assignments. You don't have to worry about it until after you finish the first homework. It'll be due a week from today. We're going to go back to Wednesday for our homework schedules.
Hey, Jeff.
Let me just stop.